I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to Open Exchanges, a new series of conversations about recent Vanderbilt publications that have been made available to anyone with an internet connection. Today I'll be talking with Bruce Morrill, Edward A. Molloy Chair of Catholic Studies and Professor of Theological Studies, about his recent article, Good Table Manners: The Presence and Participation of Fellow Christians at Roman Catholic Mass, published in the latest issue of the journal Liturgy. A copy of the article is available on Bruce's webpage at the Vanderbilt Divinity School website. Bruce, thanks for taking part in this conversation.
I'm grateful for it.
Your article appears in a special issue on the Lord's Table in a Changing World. Beyond the occasion of this special issue, why did you choose to write at this particular time about non-Catholic Christians at Roman Catholic Mass?
Well, the easiest and most basic answer is that I was invited to. So a very fine colleague, Martha Moore Kish, who teaches at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, was the guest editor for this issue, and recruited me and others along topics. But beyond the simple fact of being invited by her to contribute on that topic, I jumped at it because it remains steadily a real question. With so many people marrying in Catholics with Protestants, Jewish people, non-affiliated, you name it, it's just a good, lively, ongoing question for folks. It's a good opportunity to educate about, a topic of real interest to people,
right.
Practical interest.
Right. So your article discusses sort of this evolution in attitudes, generally in a more inclusive direction, among American Roman Catholic laity in particular, although you do talk a little bit about priests. Towards non-Catholic participation in the Mass, and specifically the Holy Communion. And then at the same time, this sort of boundary setting that's going on by the hierarchy. And while I was reading the article, I was struck by how language interacts with practice in powerful ways in these areas. And, for example, you mentioned the relatively recent acceptance in the use of the word table in reference to the Mass, which you see as a move in the direction of inclusion. And you also note the continuing choice of the word communities rather than churches to designate religious institutions that arose during the Reformation, which suggests boundary maintenance. So my question is, how important is the relationship between language and practice? And as an example, towards the end of the article, you discuss some communion procession changes that have been going on. And I'm wondering if any language changes have become associated with those changes in practice.
Oh, I see. Yes, well, let me take those severally.
Sure.
The language of table is a significant shift or change in official Roman Catholic teaching and documents, and it remains even these 50 years since the Second Vatican Council concluded, that the Second Vatican Council, being that reforming council held from 62 to 65 under Pope John the 23rd and then Paul the 6th, a council that was about reforming and renewing the Roman Catholic Church. Language of table, you see, Catholics would associate, and to this day so many do, that, well, the Mass is a sacrifice of the Mass, you know. This takes place at the altar. And yet, in the Vatican Council's dogmatic, so this is authoritative teaching, dogmatic constitution on Revelation, that particular document, uses this language of Revelation taking place at the table of God's Word and the table of the Eucharist. Even the language of Eucharist, of course, is while ancient in the tradition and always present in Catholic theology and doctrine, it wasn't the common parlance, you know. It's about Mass. You're going to Mass. We're not celebrating Eucharist. Like, whoa. So these were all changes that I grew up in. I mean, as someone myself who was just a preschooler when Vatican II happened. I grew up in a church where this language was shifting. And yet, the shifts, it's been some two steps forward and one step back.
Hmm.
From the late 70s forward, the pontificate of John Paul II, very long one, and then Benedict XVI, the great anxiety grew up among at least the hierarchy and conservative Catholics that the distinctive propitiatory, you know, sacrifice for sin, all this sort of dimensions about the Mass and Christ's death and the sacrament was getting lost somehow with language of table, with changes of architecture and space, such that a lot of churches were renovated or built with altar sanctuaries where the Eucharistic table really looks much more like a table than a sarcophagus, which is really what we get from the earlier medieval era and beyond before. So anyway, table language itself can be contested language or testy language between more progressive and traditionalist Catholics. But I do think, and you're right, for the first part of the article, I really make note of it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it opens out. Secondly, I think it reflects what I mentioned in the article, the important point about the language of the table of the Word and the table of the sacrament, because with the Second Vatican Council's mandate for reform of the liturgy came a much bigger liturgy of the Word. In other words, shifting from a short epistle and very limited readings from the Gospel of Matthew, basically, to a three-year cycle of hearing from all three synoptic Gospels plus John in every Lenten Easter season, adding a big cycle of Old Testament readings and New Testament readings. What's happened with this, I'm convinced, through my pastoral experience, is that over the years, regular church-going Catholics hear all these gospel stories repeatedly about Jesus being chided for dining with tax collectors and sinners.
Hmm.
And this collides with a church polity or a canon law, liturgical law in Roman Catholicism that says, well, no, there are these regulations over who is eligible to receive.
Mm.
So what I hear from people at times, which does not surprise me, well, wait a minute, you know, kind of the popular American sort of sloganeering, but, you know, what would Jesus do? Look what Jesus did. You know, he didn't stand there and ask people about their credentials, and in fact, you know, sinners and tax collectors and, you know, all that kind of. So I think that's exciting myself.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I like that. Even if it's not resolved, that this kind of ferment is taking place. So that's the language of table. I've mm-hmm. already forgotten the second term you picked up.
Well, community.
Oh, yes.
And churches.
That's very important.
Yeah,
communion. Yes. So the language that was even made more precise in the 1990s by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, who eventually became Pope Benedict XVI. But when he was working in John Paul II's era as his doctrinal office director and so forth, really pressed for the precision, and it all went into the documentation, the way things are written, to refer to, right, see, I'm stumbling around the words to try to not confuse it, but what we would all say,
mm-hmm.
We would say, well, those are the churches of the Reformation, the Lutheran Church, the Episcopal right. Church, the Methodist Church, the various Baptist churches, etc. No, they're not churches in this Roman Catholic understanding, official understanding. They are called ecclesial communions.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that Roman Catholicism, at least the official church, considers those not to be churches that can stand on their own and say we trace our lineage to the apostolic era.
Mm-hmm.
That they can only trace it through the Western Church, which is the Roman Church, as it were. Whereas the Roman Catholic Church does refer to the Greek Orthodox, Romanian Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, all those Orthodox churches, what we tend to call the Eastern churches, those they'll call churches.
Mm.
Because the Roman Catholic Church looks at them and says, sure, you have this lineage from the start. Granted, we had our schisms and rifts by the 11th century, but we don't question, you know, you've got this lineage. So, I think all of this just points to how powerful words are.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things we struggle with in the West between Catholics, Protestants, and even within Catholics and all, in our era is, well, is something merely a symbol or is it real, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is some of the charged debates around the Eucharist in the first place, right, or what the sacrament is. But beyond, not even looking at that, though it matters, just look at the language. I often, when I'm teaching, I try to get people to think about how to oppose symbol and reality is a very foolish mind game. It's self-deceiving because, in fact, anything that's most real, which is, I would like to say, most important in people's lives, is symbolic.
Mm.
You know, it's the only way we share stuff is symbolically. The only way, you know, yeah, you know, I'm old enough to remember the whole issue about the American flag, right? Or even people that aren't as old as me, a baby boomer, will remember then people want to pass constitutional amendments against burning the flag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, one could say, what's the big deal? It's just a symbol,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, no, symbols aren't just symbols. And so the language of ecclesial communion versus condom of church really points to still, you know, tragic as I like to consider it is. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I wish we would have a far greater, rather complete unity. Not a uniformity in Christianity, but a unity of churches. There's an honesty in this symbolic, in this language, that keeps alive the fact that we are divided and that there are these needs. And likewise, there's great power, like I say, in the language of table, because,
mm-hmm.
like I say, a lot of the more, for lack of a better word, conservative Catholics, a lot of the clergy have come now out of that long era I mentioned since the 80s, where they're doing this big effort to reform the reform, the language that's used, and make us more Roman Catholic again, you know, which of course, folks listening to this can't see this face I just made. I think we're reaching rather in the reform that the council put in process. It was one, as the introductory paragraphs to the council's constitution on the liturgy states, which is the first major document of the council. This is a reform and renewal of the Roman Catholic Church that's trying to reach back to most sound and basic tradition, and to get rid of a lot of accretions that developed. It's a sifting process.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, it's so funny that, you know, some people say, well, we've turned the Roman Catholic Church and Mass into looking like a Protestant service, which is not, I mean, well, whatever. I'm just saying, people will get into this kind of polarizing or, you know, rhetoric. But from the other side, I did my PhD at Emory University, my dissertation under Don Salyer's direction. He was one of the big leaders, tireless, of a group of Methodist scholars who worked so hard for their whole careers in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s to get, for example, the United Methodist Church to become churches that celebrate robust Eucharistic liturgies, drawing on the ancient Eucharistic prayers, you know, and all sort of thing. And they constantly were faced with, you know, you're trying to turn us into Catholics. So, so you see from both directions,
right,
huh?
Right.
Which is a good thing. I mean, this is a process that'll be going on long after I'm pushing up the daisies, I'm sure. But that language, yeah, is kind of exciting.
Yeah. And the article, the focus of the article is, as I think is probably clear from what we've been talking about so far, on Roman, on American Catholicism.
Yes.
But you know, the Code of Canon Law and a lot of the texts that are used to determine how things should be done are, of course, not just for the U.S. So how do you, this is not something I don't think you really touch on in the article very much, but how would you situate U.S. Catholics in a global context with regard to this, to this issue? I mean, where do they, are they more liberal? Are there other?
Yes, I would say I don't know about more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
What the simple fact is, we have been a nation, certainly from the 1800s,
mm-hmm.
by the early to mid-1800s, we are a nation that has been a melting pot and of ethnicities or nationalities. And granted, from the 1830s to World War II, you're talking largely it's European, mm-hmm. not exclusively, but it's European immigration from all the poverty in Carpathia, from, you know, from the Eastern Europe, where my mother's parents came from Spain, Italy, where there's so much poverty, you know, all these different places. So you have all these ethnic groups that come, and yet there was, especially in the experience of the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
that was, which I speak here from my parents. My parents were both in the war. They met in the war. My mother was an Army nurse. My dad was an Army officer. It's a charming story, but we'll let that go. But there you have an example. My mother grew up the child of Carpatho-root Russian immigrants, Russian Orthodox. She was Orthodox to her dying day, through nearly 60 years of marriage with my dad. My dad was Roman Catholic with a French-Canadian background in Maine, though his mother was English-Scottish. And so much of our cousins on that side, as I grew up, well, they went to the Congregational Church, which just tells me Scots, that would be more in a Calvinistic line. My point in that autobiographical example is the Great American Melting Pot also became one of people not making a criterion, a rigid criterion of, I'm only going to marry someone in my own quote-unquote religion.
Mm-hmm.
And people would speak that way, right? I'm so careful to word this article as other Christians at Catholic Mass. In fact, the kind of colleague who asked me to write the article originally said to me, would you write an article on non-Catholics at Mass? I'm like, I'm not going to use the language of non-Catholic. You're already negatively identified.
Which I have done. So.
But it's easier, right? It's easier.
Yeah.
But as the Roman Catholic sitting here saying, I'm going out of my way to be very careful mm-hmm. not to do that, to label. So anyway, the point would be, and I didn't even pick up on that. The point would be, especially with World War II, all of a sudden you had this remarkable mixing of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't just the war, but that era. And so that now the world we grow up in the 50s and forward is a world where you have all sorts of people in what became known as mixed marriages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Protestant with a Catholic with an Orthodox, you know, you name it. And then even with Jewish people, which is I don't want to go too far all over the map, but that's a very, very prominent phenomenon in the last few decades of Catholic-Jewish marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And so, given that, your question was, what's unique to us in the States? It's not just progressivism or liberalism. In fact, about Roman Catholics, the first thing I think is that what's so American about it is the American melting pot, the mixing,
mm-hmm.
Such that people's questions so often pastorally that I encounter, whether helping out in a parish on a Sunday or giving some adult education, their questions will be, why is it that I'm Methodist wife can't receive mm-hmm. communion with me when she's here at Mass? Now, when I go to her church, we're told everyone's welcome to the table, blah, 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 you know, but I don't mean that pejoratively, just, you know, it's worded out there. What's up?
Mm-hmm.
And in the question even, it's more of a rhetorical question. Usually the questioner, unless they're quite young, if they're people my age, if they're boomers or older, it's a rhetorical question. They know these are the rules, but they're really protesting, you know. And so that's why I'll trot out the canon law. Just to say, first of all, you know, let's just first of all talk about what's on the books. There's a whole other question about how this is implemented or not pastorally. This Pope has more recently, with all this Year of Mercy and the Synod on the Family that he ran, and now he's put that big long document, you know, the Joy of Love, put that out. Saying, well, there's got to be pastoral leeway, judgment, discernment, there's the law in the books, then there's, you know, that kind of what should be done in a given circumstance. Catholics, I think American Catholics feel free increasingly to go ahead and receive communion where they want to, if they're visiting in another church. I can't speak for everyone, but I'm just saying this is a phenomenon that has simply evolved. And likewise, well, I would say from the John Paul papacy forward, so through all the 1980s forward, with the bishops he's put in place and also Benedict XVI, they've become very, very directive and very vocal in setting out directives on who may or may not receive. And they produced a document. You see, while there's the canon law for the whole universal church, then bishops' conferences can also set their own documents, which are in line with that, but are specific. So they put out eventually very clear guidelines that they want to have appear, they require appear in the back of any hymnal that's produced. There's no one official Catholic hymnal. This often surprised Protestant folks. There isn't the Catholic hymnal. There isn't. There are different publishers who put out Catholic hymnals. But they all know now, they all are online to put in the front or the back or somewhere these statements about who may receive under what conditions. And that's what I reproduce in the article again, just to let people know. And there are, and then it ranges across dioceses. In some places, bishops expect this stuff actually to be read out at weddings, which I just find unimaginable. I can see, and what I've done at times if I help at a wedding, if that's a big issue, if that's a requirement, because the bishop is the pastor of the diocese, then put that in print in your, everyone puts out a booklet for the wedding, right? You know, with some kind of order of service. Fine, put it in the order of service, just like it would be in a missal, a missal or a hymnal in the pew. Do that. But it does make for a struggle. So I'd say the unique American situation is how pluralistic our society is. I don't think one would encounter that so much in some other parts of the world. And yet, I'm slow to say that now, because when one thinks of how pluralistic society is everywhere, I had to, with such a short article,
sure,
4,000 words, but stick it with the American context, which I think is responsible theology. But, you know, when one realizes Indonesia's got the largest number of Muslims in the world and also just millions of Catholics in Indonesia, I wonder how those things line up side by side. I would imagine, I'm speaking way out of my expertise, that there isn't much intermarriage between Muslims and Catholics in these countries. It would be very hard for me to imagine. So it may be in some of these countries, India, other places, again, I'm speaking way out of my range of knowledge or expertise. The differences there would be that the people's forming their social identities around their religion are probably stronger. And the states, the boundaries have become very, very porous and much more open. And for that reason, I think this becomes, or remains, such a lively question. Meaning, well, why can't my Protestant spouse receive in Catholic Church? Or why are you telling me that if I go to the Protestant service with my spouse, I'm not to receive there? They said I could, you know, but you're saying I can't. And then it's about apostolic succession and all this kind of stuff, you know. Well, but because it's not in one with the Universal Church, or the language would be, because some of the churches have been dialogues between the Anglican Communion and Roman Catholicism, between the Methodists and Catholics. These are called bilateral groups, bilateral dialogues, the Lutherans and Catholics. Huge agreements being reached doctrinally. You know, the one that was so celebrated, but I don't know what the practical impact, on justification by faith between the Lutherans and the Catholics, for example. But on communion, between the Methodists and the Catholics, between the Anglicans and the Catholics, basically, yeah, I can say in a shorthand, these questions are resolved theologically, largely. Certainly with the Anglicans. But then the next issue, certainly with the Anglicans, but then the next issue is, but your bishops are not in union with the Bishop of Rome. And until that happens, we're not really in communion. And communion, and here's the other step that is the really interesting wrinkle in all this, that Roman Catholics in America, largely, with the exception of the more very small percentage of what I would call very conservative Catholics, Catholics largely see Holy Communion in a very individualistic way. Even though the theology from the get-go historically, always on the books, and then what we've tried to do is renewal, me as a sacramental theologian, is no, communion is, when we receive and share communion, we're sharing in the body of Christ, which we are. You know, the act of communion should be this ecclesial act. People see this as, I'm receiving my Jesus. And it was a big issue several elections ago, back in 2004, when John Kerry was the Democratic candidate for president, when all these certain very conservative and archbishops and bishops were making all this noise that he wouldn't be welcome to receive communion in their diocese if he was campaigning there because he was supportive of abortion rights and things like this. the reaction of your Josephine Catholic on the street that would be in these articles in the Times or wherever were consistently, to my reading, were consistently, no bishop should be saying that, you know, whether John Kerry can receive communion is between him and his God. It's like, wow, you know, to me that's when you really see this huge gap, this divide, this chasm, this canyon between the average Catholic layperson's idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what they think is going on. That's a theology. Holy Communion's a matter of the individual Catholic and his or her God.
Mm.
Wow. Versus everything that, like I say, is in the official church teaching and practice, plus a lot of the theology, period, historically and contemporary. Wait a minute, whoa, no, we're individuals, but we're all members of the body of Christ, and in fact, the full fruits, if you will, of the communion service is realized in the communion of the body, in the members. It's trying to build up the church for its mission in the world, this kind of thing. Well, I mean, a lot of Catholics by now would either be yawning or looking at their watch, like, believe me, because I do this and that's what happens. I hope you see my point.
Yeah.
There's this big divide.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me that Roman Catholics are sort of flummoxed by, well, what's the big deal?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is between individuals and their God. Which, of course, really then is a huge indicator of how they view what a bishop is,
mm-hmm.
right? Or how much influence a bishop should have in their life.
Right.
So there you go, American Catholicism. I mean, I'm not a sociologist of religion, but I got enough brains and I can read. I just read a lot. I try to, whenever I see these things coming up in the wider press or in other places, I try to read. I really try to gobble it up as a sacramental theologian because I want it not just to be lofty theories. I want it to see what's going on in
right.
practice, hence the article. The next book really I want to work on is what I was just talking about.
Oh.
Like, what would it be like to write a book? I want to get to it because it's always a moving target, but given that gap I just described, speaking metaphorically, how to write a book about sacraments in the American context, because again, I can't write for everything, and I'd probably be writing for the Anglo-American context, which someone could come right back at me and say, yeah, but the whole growing area is Hispanic, yeah, so I can't speak for that. I don't know that, and I'm getting old. I don't, you know, but to speak to this phenomenon, at least in this part of American Catholicism, how to write a book that would simply identify those differences, just simply account for them, recount them, and then give some analysis, but include in it, like I did in this shorter article, in a way it was an opportunity that opens this to me, but include with it also people from both ends of the spectrum need to be educated on what is on the books,
because
everybody's going to have their own, well, it must mean this, well, let's just also... So it's a book I hope would be useful for... So Roman Catholicism is unique in its canon law system. No other Christianity has such a complex legal system. What are we talking about in each case, each sacrament? And then what's been going on? What has evolved?
Hmm.
And how are people talking past each other?
Hmm.
And then, I mean, I'm a theologian. We make normative claims. I would certainly weigh in on what I think should happen. But thanks for letting me talk out what I think the next.
That's thank you for conversing with me about your article and forthcoming material.
Yes,
that's right.
Articles can launch books. So, yeah.
Great. Again, the article is Good Table Manners. I have to say this with an rising intonation, indicating a question mark. Good Table Manners, the Presence and Participation of Fellow Christians at Roman Catholic Mass. The author is Bruce Morrill, Edward A. Malloy, Chair of Catholic Studies and Professor of Theological Studies. For an open access version of the article, as well as a link to the published version, browse to divinity.vanderbilt.edu and look for Bruce Morrill under the faculty staff link. Let us know what you think about the article and this conversation, and thanks for listening.